Great. Okay. Now, what I want to say is something about before the Big Bang. And I should say that the question of what happened before the Big Bang, if I'd been asked that a bit over a year ago, I would have given the conventional answer. And the conventional answer, in case you don't know it, was given by Stephen Hawking in what's called the Richard and Judy Show. Now, you may not know who Richard and Judy are. Americans know who Oprah Winfrey is, and I think that's a sort of comparison. And I'm told that there's a Canadian, I just have the word here, Vicky Gaboreau, is that right? Okay, so anyway, you get the idea. And Stephen was asked this question at the end, and it was, you know, what happened before the Big Bang? And he said, as I say, the conventional answer, well, the Big Bang was a singularity. The very notions of space and time ceased to have meaning, and therefore it's a meaningless question to ask what happened before the Big Bang. And that's what I would have said too. So I'm going to give you a different answer to this question, and that's what the talk's about. Before I give you my answer, let me mention a few crazy ideas. I should say they're all these ideas are crazy, and the question is which ones are less crazy or worth thinking about because they do something else. So before the Big Bang, I have to make sure I do this all the right way. Well, I suppose these go back to Friedman and so on, where, well, probably way before that, lots of people had crazy cosmologies. But Friedman introduced his solutions of the Einstein equations for a cosmology, and the closed universe Friedman model has, as a function of time, the radius of the universe behaving like a cycloid. And so rather than thinking, well, here's your singularity, and that's the end, this is the beginning and that's the end, it's tempting to think that each cycle of this cycloid has an actual existence, and so somehow you're going to get through this Big Bang to the next phase. Well, Tolman was worrying about the second law of thermodynamics, and how do you have a second law which manages to get through this singular state here? And so he had an idea. At least he tried to address this issue of the second law, even though one needs to do a lot more than he did. But in his proposal, he had these cycles not all the same as each other, and I think they got bigger as time went on. Now, I'm not going to go into that. But at least Tolman was taking that seriously. Now, here are some other ideas. Here we have, Wheeler had the idea that the constants of nature might change from one cycle to the next. So it's something like this or this, but where the constants of nature, the absolute pure numbers of nature, which are, you know, quite mysterious, but the idea was that perhaps somehow they got churned around and changed each new cycle. Well, our local Lee Smolin has his own version of this, where indeed the constants of nature are allowed to be changed when you go through the singular state. In his model, the singularities of black holes, that's what these things are supposed to be here. Time, in most of my pictures, will be going more or less up the page, and that's what they're trying to do here, but it's a bit hard to draw it all. And here we have a singularity in a black hole, which represents the new universe, and you have these new universes sprouting off the old ones, and it incorporates the Wheeler idea about constants of nature changing from one to the next. The thing that worries me, well, there's more than one thing that worries me about this, but one of them has to do with the geometry not really fitting. It's true that you have a singular state in the black hole and you have a singular state in the Big Bang, but if you try to match these together in any sensible way, it's pretty difficult. And also, there's the issue of the second law, which doesn't really seem to be faced up to in this model here, but it's a cute idea. Now, here we have some other ideas. This is the ekpyrotic view of Steinhardt and Turok and various people, where you have these things called D brains, which are colliding, and somehow that results in the next Big Bang. and there are oscillating versions of this as well. These all use extra dimensions, so you have to believe in the extra dimensions as well as these other things here. But all of these ideas have difficulties with the second law of thermodynamics. I should say there's a model of Veneziano's, which is probably the most like the things I want to say, but there's also a Steinhardt-Turok version, which has some resemblances to what I want to say, but I think they're not terribly, they don't go very far. Okay, well, let's go back and have a look at the standard models. I mentioned Friedman, and these basically are the first serious cosmological models based on Einstein's general relativity. Time going up the page. As I say, the time will do in pretty well all my diagrams. Here we have the Big Bang at the beginning, and the negative spatial curvature model, zero spatial curvature and positive spatial curvature, that's what that K is. And you see a relationship between the spatial curvature and the temporal behavior. So if it's closed spatially, it's also closed temporally. So one has not only a big bang, but also a big crunch in this positive curvature model here. Now, it's useful if you want to explain to a general audience what these different kinds of geometry are like, to appeal to Escher. So one can show these pictures here. Here we have three different ways of covering a plane with angels and devils in some tessellation, representing these three different geometries. Here we have a usual Euclidean plane. Here we have a sphere. And here we have hyperbolic geometry. It's a very nice way of describing hyperbolic geometry in a glance. It also exhibits a feature which I want to stress and which will have importance later on in what I want to say. This representation, usually referred to as the Poincaré disk, actually due to Beltrami some years before Poincaré, is what's called a conformal representation. So if you take small shapes or angles in this model here, they are accurately represented in the Euclidean geometry in which this is drawn. So you have the entire hyperbolic space, of course, just two-dimensional here, the entire hyperbolic space represented as a part of Euclidean space in a way which is conformal, so that the, as I say, angles or small shapes are accurately represented. Distances, of course, are not accurately represented, so the angels and the devils get smaller and smaller with respect to the Euclidean geometry as you go up to the edge, whereas the angels or the devils would themselves regard themselves as being the same wherever they are in the picture. So the metric that they use, the rulers that they would use would be, in the Euclidean picture, very much smaller here than they are here. Now the feature I want to stress here is that you see the entire hyperbolic geometry represented as a portion of the Euclidean plane. And you have this bounding circle which represents infinity for the hyperbolic geometry. So infinity, the entire universe here, including right out to infinity, the boundary, of course, not being part of hyperbolic space, but the open set within that boundary does represent the hyperbolic space. But you see infinity is represented as a perfectly smooth, finite region where the conformal geometry works perfectly well. It's just there's an infinite stretching factor which would be required to go from the metric of the Euclidean space to the metric of the intrinsic metric of the space itself. Okay, so bear that in mind, because that will have some relevance to things I want to say later on. But what I do want to talk about is the issue that I touched upon earlier, namely the second law of thermodynamics, and that in a certain sense makes this picture not as accurate as you were saying. It's not all that accurate anyway, but it has this kind of symmetry about it which one might think might be disturbed by the incorporating the second law of thermodynamics, which is a time asymmetrical law. Well, here's it's often nice to have cartoons and things that represent what's going on with the second law. So here we have three pictures. One with a wine glass perched on the edge of the table, the next one where it's fallen off and the wine spilling out, and finally you have the glass broken on the ground and the wine getting absorbed into the carpet or the grass or whatever it is. And although it doesn't, as far as Newtonian dynamics is concerned, it could be this is the first, this is the second, and this is the third, or it could be the other way around. So you have just as good description in terms of Newtonian mechanics, whichever way it goes, because the laws of Newton are symmetrical in time. However, you never see this, this, and this that way around. In practice, one always sees it this way around, and the way one understands that is in terms of this quantity, the entropy, which is increasing as you go in this direction, and the second law tells you that the entropy should increase. Here I have a wonderful formula due to Boltzmann, which makes the concept of entropy much more precise than it had been before. There are still certain issues one can raise about it, but it's a very elegant formula, where we have S, the entropy, as being K times, well, K is the only thing that's not due to Boltzmann in that formula, namely Boltzmann's constant. Apparently he didn't worry too much about actual values of things. And here we have the logarithm of a V. Well, V is a volume. What volume is that? Well, that's a volume in phase space. So here we have a picture of phase space. You have to imagine that this is, it's a cartoon, of course, that phase space, every point in phase space represents a single state of the what's going on inside this picture, where the all the individual particles, their positions give you coordinates and their momenta give you coordinates, and so you have to each of those coordinates has to be combined to give you the coordinate for this whole space here. So it's a huge number of dimensions, depending on the number of particles. And the point for the Boltzmann formula is that you need to have what's called a coarse graining of this space, where the, roughly speaking, you say, well, you have a lot of bubbles here or compartments where two points in the same compartment are considered to be indistinguishable with regard to macroscopic parameters. So that means, for example, you wouldn't care where the individual atoms or molecules of gas were. All you would be primarily interested in would be gross parameters like the density and the pressure and the velocity of the gas and so on and so forth. And if you keep track of those parameters and say the two states for which the macroscopic parameters are the same are lumped together into one of these regions here, then this region, which is a coarse graining region, the volume of that is what you're concerned with. Now, a point about this is that, well, the space, I mean, you can't draw it so that it really is representative in this respect. That is, not only does this space have a huge number of dimensions, but the relative sizes between the relative volumes, if you like, of different coarse graining regions tend to be absolutely stupendous. So although this one looks a little bigger than that, you have to bear in mind that it's absolutely stupendously bigger than that. And the fact that you've got a logarithm in this formula helps, that even though the volumes may differ by stupendous amounts, when you've taken a logarithm, it may not be so bad. And the K being a small number too helps too. So you may have a fairly reasonable looking quantity to measure your entropy, whereas the actual volumes that they describe of these regions, these volumes may differ absolutely enormously. So that you now sort of understand the second law here by saying we start off in a certain region which has a volume of a certain size, and the ones surrounding it, most of them will be, well, there are a lot of tiny ones, but this point will wander around in some way, and it's overwhelmingly likely, if you're just thinking about what the likelihood of what might happen, and don't worry about dynamics too much, it's overwhelmingly probable that it will reach a larger and larger volume as it goes. And once it gets into a bigger volume, it's just by pure chance, it's exceedingly unlikely that it would reach a smaller one again. So you can more or less ignore that possibility. And so this gives you an explanation for why the second law holds and the entropy increases. Here we have the largest volume of all, which we refer to as thermal equilibrium. It's so big that it tends to be much bigger even than the union of all the other volumes to get put together. So that gives you a feeling for what goes on and why you get into larger and larger volumes and why the second law holds. Now that, if you like, gives an explanation. Well, let's put it like this. This is the entropy going up this way, and here we have now, and it's telling you why, if you predict what's going to happen in the future, the entropy is going to go up. The only trouble with this argument is that it also gives you, it gives you the right answer into the future, but it gives you a completely wrong answer in the past, because you might say, okay, let's try and use this argument to ask how this glass got up here in the first place. So you say, well, what is the most likely way that it could find its way perched on the edge of the table there? And you simply use the same argument as here. You say, if you know it's in some region, and then you say, what is the most likely way to get into that region? The most likely way is that it started as a mess on the ground like this. It jumped up and all the wines found its way into the glass, and it's ended up sitting on the edge of the table. Well, that's the correct answer if this is all you're going to go on. But of course, it's the wrong answer if you ask what actually happens in any physical situation that we experience. And the correct answer is that somebody came along and put it on the corner like that. And in fact, that was just in accordance with the second law. So we can look at this diagram at the bottom. Here is the predicted answer using this argument. That's fine. That's more or less what we see. And here is the retrodicted answer using this argument, completely wrong, because what actually happened is the entropy went down in the past. So that's somehow we've got to understand that. And that really saying that this randomness picture isn't right, that somehow there is something pulling it down into smaller and smaller regions as you go back. And so the picture is more like this. You have to work your way back and finally get back to the Big Bang. So the Big Bang represents, in order for the second law to have held all the way up till now, the Big Bang has to have been a very small entropy state. And there has to be some other reason, completely different from the kind of argument that I've been using here, for why the universe has to have started in a very small entropy state. And to ensure the entropy continues to go down in the past, we need an enormous constraint on the space-time geometry at the Big Bang. Well, I want to say something why it is space-time geometry and not something else. And a reason for that is, well, you might say, why do we believe in a Big Bang at all? And one of the most powerful pieces of evidence has to do with the microwave background, this radiation coming at us from a very early stage of the universe. Sometimes people refer to that as the flash of the Big Bang, cooled down as the universe expanded to about 2.7 degrees absolute. And here is a curve. This is a slightly old curve. This is just the COBE one, I think, which is representing the frequency this way and the intensity that way. And we have a solid curve, which is a Planck curve for 2.7 degrees or something, which represents what you would expect if you're looking at something in thermal equilibrium. So you look back and you see what seems very closely to be thermal equilibrium, because the observation points, the data points, which is little boxes here, lie so very precisely on this curve. I should say that if you look at the new data, well, if you look at the data from WMAP and so on, these boxes are so small that you can't even see them. The curve is extraordinarily precise. So this piece of evidence, which tells us that there was this hot early state of the universe, is also telling us that the matter in the universe was extraordinarily close to being in thermal equilibrium. Well, there is an element of paradox there, because I said, shouldn't the early state of the universe be something very special and therefore very low entropy, whereas the evidence that we seem to be relying on here is telling us that you're looking at something of maximal entropy. You're seeing a thermal equilibrium state. So how could it have been the maximum entropy at the early stage and having been going up ever since? Well, sometimes people say it's because the universe was very small then, and so there wasn't much room for big entropy or something. That argument as it stands simply isn't right, because if you trace whatever the dynamics is, if the local dynamics is time reversible, then you say, what would happen if you imagine a collapsing universe in which you had a second law still holding? The degrees of freedom have got to go somewhere. And so just because the universe is getting smaller, after all, the size of the universe is a dynamical parameter which has to be incorporated into one's phase space volume if you do it correctly. So you can't very well. It would be a genuine consideration if the universe was somehow something given with a given size and so on. But that's part of the dynamics, so you can't extract the size of the universe away from other parameters. In fact, if we look at this more carefully, what we find is that the universe was, in fact, very random, if you like, with regard to the matter. So that's what you're looking at when you look at that curve. So the Planck curve, which I have here, is really telling you what the matter in the universe was like, and it was essentially in thermal equilibrium. But the universe has other parameters governing its behavior, and the other parameters have to do with the geometry of the universe. And this is to do with gravity. So the question is, the issue seems to be that the universe was very special with regard to gravity, but not at all special with regard to other parameters. I'll put this, I think, another way, by considering. Here we have another sketch of phase space of the universe as a whole. And here we have a yellow region which represents what we seem to see now. And here we have a curve which represents the history of the universe. Oh, sorry, it was better before, wasn't it? There we are. And so, well, first of all, if that was, suppose the universe was just completely random, well, then you'd expect it would be somewhere out there. Okay, maybe it would dip down into some smaller region of a fluctuation, but on the whole, it would be in the maximum entropy region. However, knowing that the universe is not like that now, say that we've got this yellow region, you might then say, okay, knowing that now is in there, what's the most likely place for this curve to be? Well, the most likely place is such that whichever direction you trace it in, you find the volumes getting larger and larger. That does not seem to accord with observations. What does more accord with it is that the t equals zero, or the beginning of the universe, was in this tiny region here, which represents the Big Bang, and surrounding it were other regions that were also pretty tiny, and the second law is to be understood in that way. So somehow you have to see why it is that we started in this very tiny region. Now, I said, okay, as far as the matter is concerned, the early universe was basically in thermal equilibrium, but what about the geometry of the universe? Well, if you bring gravity in the picture, you have to worry about this sort of thing. Here I have two boxes, one of them containing a gas, which we considered to be initially in one corner. You sort of put it in a box in the corner, and then you open the lids here, and the gas spreads out, and that's in accordance with the second law. But if you imagine this not just to be gas particles running around, but gravitating bodies, like stars or something, then there is a tendency in the opposite direction for these things to clump. And so whereas with just the gas, it spreads out and you get it more and more uniform. With gravitating body, there's this tendency for it to clump. So in our actual universe, what we find is in the early stages of the universe, a very great uniformity. So it's really like this and like this together. So it's, as far as matter's concerned, yes, it's up here, thermal equilibrium. And as far as gravity is concerned, it's here, which is a very special state. So it's what actually happens will be some complicated mixture of all this. But I'd like to make the point that the gravitational clumping, which is represents an increase of entropy, and there is the potential for this to happen because the universe was very uniform. So let's see, what we find about the universe is, okay, the matter was in thermal equilibrium, but as far as gravity is concerned, what one found was a very uniform universe, and that very uniform universe represents a low state of entropy with regard to gravity. And that actually is very, very important. And for example, you might ask how it is that life on Earth benefits from this. Well, you see, here I have a picture representing how life benefits from the presence of the sun. Of course, superficially you say, well, the sun is useful to us because it provides us with energy, but that's not really the answer, because the sun gives us energy in the daytime and in the night, or also in the day, the same amount of energy, basically the same amount of energy escapes back into space. So you get this balance, otherwise the Earth would just get hotter and hotter. of course it is because of global warming and all that, but that's on this scale a small effect, serious though it may be. The picture I want to show you here is that the energy we get from the sun is in the form of you see the sun is much hotter than the background, and this means that the individual photons that you get from the sun are of higher frequency than the ones that go back. And being of higher frequency, by Planck's formula, they have individually greater energy. So you have a smaller number of photons coming in and a much larger number of photons going out, because these incoming photons are much more energetic than the outgoing ones. So you need far more of them to go out. These are infrared photons here, basically yellow light coming in. And in order for the energy balance to happen, you need far more photons going away than coming in. So more photons means more degrees of freedom. That means larger phase space volume. So the point is that the energy going out corresponds to a much larger phase space volume than the energy going in. So that's basically what we live off, or the plants live off this, and they convert the high energy photons to lower ones in order to build their substance up, and then animals and us take advantage of this, and that's how life keeps going on the Earth. So the point is not that you get energy from the sun, but that the sun is hotter than the background. You have this imbalance in temperature in the background, and that comes about from the sun being a hot spot in an otherwise dark sky. Then you say, well, why is it that the sun is a hot spot in a dark sky? Well, all sorts of things are going on in the sun, but the crucial thing is that the sun is there at all, and it's there at all because of gravitational clumping. So it is, in fact, a detailed result of this process over here. So you have the gas that was previously more uniformly spread, gradually clumping, producing these hot places in the sky. So the temperature is not balanced over the sky, and that's what we live off. Okay, well, this is all very basic. In fact, I haven't said anything that's particularly outrageous as yet, despite the word outrageous being in the title. Now, I actually want to go back briefly to my Friedman models, wherever I put them, which must have been down here. Need a bit more space, I think. Here they are. Okay. So those were the models that I showed you before. And we now have to try and bring in the second law of thermodynamics as best we can. And this means that we have to incorporate the gravitational clumping. And I should make the point that we had in this picture here, the maximally clumped state will be a black hole. So this, it keeps on clumping and clumping until you get the black holes. And the black holes are things with singularities in the middle. So the picture is much more like this now. You have a singularity at the beginning, representing the Big Bang, and these black hole singularities representing the clumping of gravity. You see, it's most extreme, if you like, in this model here, where we had singularities looking like each other, whereas, in fact, the more accurate picture is a great mess of congealing black holes in the future, which I've tried to indicate there. Now, these pictures are not totally accurate in one other important respect. I hadn't up to this point included the cosmological constant, or dark energy, or whatever you like to call it. Basically, this notion introduced by Einstein in 1917, because he wanted a static universe and found he needed this constant. But then when he realized that he'd missed the opportunity to predict the universe was expanding, by not taking his equations as he then had them seriously, he retracted. However, once introduced, these things don't go away easily, which is just as well, because what we seem to find is that there is something at least like a cosmological constant in the observations of the universe's expansion. So you get this accelerated expansion, whichever model it is now. Actually, it doesn't make so much difference now which kind of curvature you've got. They all behave more or less the same in the remote future. You have an expansion which is accelerating, an exponentially accelerating expansion in the remote future, which has already started to make its presence known. So those are more accurate universes. And we now should incorporate the black holes too. So this is the sort of picture that we have. Some of you might worry about where inflation is in these pictures. Well, it doesn't matter whether it's here or not, because it's tucked in so close to the Big Bang that you wouldn't know on this scale whether it was there or not. So I may come back to inflation later on, but as far as these pictures are concerned, it doesn't make any difference. Okay. Now, the thing is that the Big Bang was very, very uniform. The black holes are not. They're irregular in some way. In fact, here is a picture of a collapse to a black hole. I'll come back to this picture later. Time going up the page again. These are the light cones. And we see there's matter collapsing down to a singularity. Here we have the horizon where the light cones are tipped up tangential to this space-time hypersurface. And so signals can't get out from the inside to the outside. But that's just to give you a feeling for what black holes are like according to Einstein's general theory of relativity. And you have to imagine these things are sitting all the way, all these red lines there representing these singularities. Now, the Big Bang has to have been a very special state. And you can ask how special it is. And one way of estimating the degree of specialness is to compare the, well, considering if you, say, took all the matter that it lies within our observable universe and ask what the maximum entropy state would have been for all that matter, well, the thing you can do is to consider all that matter collapsed into a black hole and then use the famous Bekenstein-Hawking formula for the entropy of a black hole. And that tells you how much entropy there was available if all that matter had been concentrated into one black hole. And this gives you an estimate of what the maximum entropy would have been. And so that tells you that how special the Big Bang must have been. And if you put all this together, what you find is that the chance of the Big Bang coming about, even remotely, like what we see, is something like 1 in 10 to the power 10 to the power 123. In fact, this expression I've given here does not include the dark matter, which is most of the matter in the universe, and so this 123 is actually a lot bigger. I mean, it should be a number a lot bigger than that 123, but this, I'll use this figure here because that's, we don't know what the dark matter is, and maybe we're safer just to use the baryonic matter. It's good enough. We still get a huge improbability for this initial state. In fact, this is the issue that I really want to try and concentrate on. Why, or can one have a theory which somehow explains this extraordinary precision in the geometry of the Big Bang? And none of the models that I really mentioned to you at the beginning of this talk even begin to take this into account. They usually don't even mention it. So although I regard this as one of the, probably the biggest problem in cosmology, how this precision can have come about in a sense, none of the models, these exotic models which I put to you, make even a stab at trying to explain this number here. So what I'm going to try and do is to give you some, give you a proposal which is trying to make a stab at that number here. Okay. Well, here I've got another picture which you can latch onto the one we had before. The Big Bang singularity was enormously constrained to something like one part in much more than 10 to the 10 to the 123, and it's the gravitational degrees of freedom which seem not to have been excited in the early stage. And I put forward this hypothesis, purely as a hypothesis, which is what I call the Weyl curvature hypothesis, which says that the initial singularities, but not the final ones, so it's an asymmetrical hypothesis with regard to time, these singularities, the initial ones, are constrained to have Weyl curvature zero, or very close to zero. I should try and explain a little bit about what the Weyl curvature is, because I can't really assume everybody here is familiar with this. So let me just give you a quick rundown on what's needed. Here we have an astronaut in space surrounded. You see, Einstein's principle of equivalence says that this astronaut will not, if the astronaut is falling freely, and falling freely can be in orbit, it doesn't have to fall to the Earth center, that astronaut will not feel a gravitational force. So falling freely will, in effect, eliminate the gravitational field. But that's not completely precise, because if you have an extended object, you will actually feel the gravitational field as a tidal effect. And this can be seen by imagining the astronaut is surrounded by a sphere of particles, initially at rest with respect to the astronaut, and then because of these differences in the acceleration, whether you're displaced closer to the Earth, where the acceleration is a little more, further away, where it's a little less, out to the side, where it's a little inwards, and what you will find is that this sphere will get distorted into an ellipsoid. That ellipsoid, because of the form of the inverse square law, will be initially of the same volume as the sphere that you start with. And that's a feature of there being empty space inside the sphere. If there were matter, and here I've considered a slightly different situation with the sphere surrounding the Earth itself, and now there's a lot of matter inside that sphere, and so there's an initial reduction in the volume. So Newton's equations or Einstein's equations tell you that the volume reduction is proportional to the amount of matter surrounded. In Newton's theory, it's exact in all situations. In Einstein's theory, it's a good approximation. Okay, so that's how one incorporates the idea of gravitational field in general relativity. But the thing is that these distortions or volume reductions are measures of space-time curvature. It's a tidal distortion effect, which is here the volume, the effects which preserve volume, the distortion is due to the Weyl curvature, and the volume reduction is due to the Ricci curvature. This is a slightly simplified description, and I'll give you a slightly more accurate picture in a minute. But here we have the space-time versions of these processes. So you have the initial sphere here, represented as this part, time going upwards, as before. And here we have some of the geodesics. Those are the free-fall lines, or the straightest lines you can draw in the space-time. They move inwards for these ones here, and they move outwards for these ones here. So you see this distortion effect is the Weyl curvature part, and the reduction of volume is the Ricci curvature part. It's a little bit more precise if we think in terms of light rays, so let's do it in terms of light rays. Here we have the Weyl curvature part and the Ricci curvature part as different effects on light rays. So here you have an observer looking at some object, which is, say, the sun, and it's acting as a lens so that the distant stars that you're looking at are displaced by the field. This is, of course, what Eddington was concerned with when he provided his test of general relativity just shortly after the end of the First World War. And here we have the stars get displaced outwards because of this focusing effect. And as they get displaced outwards, an initially circular image will be distorted into an ellipse. That's the distortion due to Weyl curvature. Whereas if you were able to look through the sun, you would see an expansion effect, a magnification due to the Ricci tensor. So you can separate out these two parts of the curvature in these ways. The Ricci curvature, another way of thinking of it, it's a bit like electromagnetic theory. In Maxwell's theory, you have two tensors of importance, one of them being the Maxwell field tensor, which describes the electromagnetic field. Think of that as the analog of the Weyl tensor, and the other is the charge current vector, which describes the sources. And the Maxwell theory has to do with how these things interrelate with each other. In general relativity, well, there's a slight difference, so the differential orders are different, but don't worry too much about that. In Einstein's theory, you have two things rather similar, the Weyl tensor, which is the analog of the Maxwell field tensor, and the Ricci tensor, which is the analog of the charge current vector. This is the source thing, and this is the free field. So that kind of separation is useful to think about. And here's a space-time picture of what's going on there. It's also rather nice that one can see the Weyl curvature almost directly, because this is just gravitational lensing. And here we have pictures like this, which show there's a presence of some body here, which is causing the images of distant galaxies to be somewhat stretched out in around here. And so you just have to look at it rather casually. You see this lensing effect, which is a distortion, and that's due to the Weyl tensor of the object in the middle, which is acting as the lens, you see. Well, it's the lens, if you like, is in the field outside. So you can more or less see Weyl tensor. Okay. So that's the idea. Somehow the Weyl tensor in the early universe was small or zero, and this doesn't apply to the singularities which occur later on. Now, where does one go from there? Well, the sort of thing that I think, I mean, a bit over a year ago, I started worrying about the universe and its expansion and so on. You know, one does this from time to time. And here is the universe. It doesn't matter too much which of these models it is. And it just expands like this. We are living somewhere in here, which is an exciting time. But the universe as a whole seems incredibly boring. You see, it just goes on expanding, expanding, and things just get more dispersed. And what could be more boring? Well, the most boring thing of all, it seems to me, is according to Stephen Hawking, black holes form, and, well, according to Stephen Hawking, that the black holes will actually radiate a tiny amount of radiation. Okay, it doesn't matter too much because it's a very, very cold temperature for any black hole that has come about by collapse of astronomical bodies. But in the long run, when the universe gets less and less dense and there's nothing left out there but a little bit of radiation running around, and the temperature goes down and down and down until it gets even lower than the temperature of a black hole. And then after that, the black hole sits around for ages and ages and ages and starts to evaporate away. I have a picture of this here, so let me show you this picture. In fact, I'll just show you it in this form here. Here we have a black hole sitting around. Here's where it's produced by the collapse of some body, a star or something. It sits around for a long, long time, and then as the radiation, the temperature and the radiation in the background goes down, eventually it becomes, the black hole becomes hotter than that. It can be pretty cold. It can be, you know, the sort of thing that the lowest temperature is ever produced in the lab and so on. But, okay, eventually this becomes hotter than the background, and then the black hole starts to radiate away, and finally it goes off with a pop. Well, nobody really knows what happens here, but I put pop there because, rather than bang, because it's a pretty mild explosion with regard to, well, it's like a, okay, it'll be rather not very nice if a bomb went off in this room of that size, but it wouldn't do too much damage to the building as far as I know. So it's not much of an astronomical explosion. And this can have been a huge black hole, which was maybe galactic, the kind of black holes you find in galactic centers. Ultimately, it goes off pop. Just imagine sitting around waiting for that to happen. I don't know exactly how long it takes, but when I say the universe is boring, that's the sort of thing you've got to wait for. And then when they're all gone, it becomes even more boring. Okay, well, maybe it just is boring. But it seemed to me that if it's boring, who's going to be around there to be bored by it? Well, not us, that's for sure. And the only things that are around to be bored by this boring universe are things like photons. And after all, photons aren't easily bored, because photons, after all, according to relativistic effects, don't experience the passage of time at all. So as far as a photon is concerned, eternity is no big deal at all. It just happens, and that's it, the end of it. So as far as a photon is concerned, it's not that boring. So it seemed to me, maybe the geometry that's relevant to the universe in these late stages is not really the one we're used to, but conformal geometry. So here we have a picture in space-time. Remember, I had the Escher picture, which I told you to keep in mind. Here we have an Escher picture, and this description here is a conformal representation of the hyperbolic universe, so that angles are correctly represented in the background. Now, you can do something similar in Lorentzian geometry of relativity, and you now have, well, the light cones are the things which are insensitive to changes of scale of the metric. So here I have a light cone drawn, and we see these surfaces of constant time from the center here, representing the ticks of a equal time interval of different clocks going at different speeds here. In fact, the clock measurements are really the things which measure the metric in relativity theory. If you want to have distant measurements, you can think of light signals going out and in and so on. But the clocks are the things which really measure the metric. And the other way around is, if you don't have the metric, or if there's nothing in the physical world left which is sensitive to the metric, but only to the light cones. You see, massless radiation, if you like, only knows where the light cones are. The equations satisfied by Maxwell's equations and other equations for massless entities have this property of being conformally invariant, which means that they know where the light cones are, but they don't have any means of keeping time. Now, put it another way, there's no way you can build a clock out of these massless entities. So the point of view here is that in the very, very remote future, the universe forgets how to keep time, and that the geometry of that universe is best thought of as a conformal geometry. So where the light cones are is still important, but not the scaling which gives you the metric. In fact, this is almost all the metric. You see, the metric in four dimensions has 10 components, and one of those components, if you like, can be thought of as giving you the scale, and the other nine as telling you where the light cone is. So it's almost all the metric. The light cone is 9 components out of 10 of the metric. So it's most of the structure, and it's the most important structure. It tells you the causal properties and so on. But it doesn't give you quite everything, but it's almost everything. So conformal geometry is an important area, and I've been interested in it for many, many years. And you can do all sorts of things with conformal geometry. Here, I just show you these things called strict conformal diagrams. But the idea of a strict conformal diagram is actually due to Brandon Carter. I started drawing things like this before, but he had this strict idea of how to interpret these diagrams, which is very useful in many circumstances. And it's very useful if you want to have a space-time which is spherically symmetrical. But then you can think of every point in your diagram. Let's think of this one here, which represents Minkowski space. Every point in the interior of this picture represents a sphere. So you have to think of this thing as rotated around the dotted line being an axis here. So you rotate the whole thing around that, but rotate it in two dimensions. That's a bit hard to visualize. But just for the sake of visualization, you might as well think of it as just rotating in one dimension. And that gives you Minkowski space, this picture does, where the conventions are that if I have a filled-in point, and I've drawn them green here, they represent points. If it's an open one, that represents a sphere. Infinity, you can make finite in these diagrams. It's represented by a purple continuous line, and the wiggly line represents a singularity. So these pictures are what I've shown you here are the various. This is Minkowski space. This is collapsed to a black hole, and here's the singularity there, showing you that it's really space-like, but once you get close to that, you hit it and can't escape from it. These are the different cosmologies that I showed you first, the Friedman version, positive curvature, zero curvature, negative spatial curvature. And here we have the versions with the cosmological constant, which seem to be more appropriate to the universe as we actually seem to find it. And now that's one important thing about these pictures here, the bottom three, is that they are more or less symmetrical up and down, except that I've got infinity at the top and the black hole singularity at the bottom. Now this reflects something which is very handy. Conformal transformations are very, very useful for describing infinity. So, in fact, that's one of the. Let's start with this side here. These are pictures showing you how you can use conformal transformations to study radiation. So here we have a system of bodies spiraling around each other or something and producing gravitational waves. And a handy way of talking about gravitational waves has been to introduce a conformal factor. So you have the original metric here. This rescales it to what one usually refers to as an unphysical metric, but it's just the same metric as this, except that you have introduced a variable scale, variable from place to place, but the light cones are unchanged from where they were before, but the actual metric is changed. So let's say 9 out of the 10 components are unchanged in this description, but the scaling is changed. But what you can do here by this trick is to make infinity finite, and it's a very handy way of discussing things which you need to go out to infinity to describe, like the total energy of the system, and the intensity of the radiation, and things like this. So it's very handy, but it's a trick. Now this is the situation it looks like when you have a zero cosmological constant, where the infinity is actually a null surface. So your light cones out here are tangential to this boundary. However, if you have a positive cosmological constant, then the infinity turns out to be space-like. That was a feature of the pictures that I just showed you a moment ago. But here we have infinity, where the omega is the conformal factor, has gone down to zero, and here we have a system radiating gravitational waves, and they leave their mark out on infinity, and you can study how they behave in various properties like energy transport and so on. But this is a handy picture to describe infinity. Now, the converse to this trick is one which has been exploited particularly by Paul Todd, and it's a very nice mathematical way of describing the Weyl curvature hypothesis. Remember, the Weyl curvature hypothesis said that the Weyl curvature went to zero or something like that close to the Big Bang, and Paul Todd now translates that into the statement that the Big Bang singularity can be extended to a past boundary which fits on very smoothly. So that's the idea, and it enables you to do lots of nice calculations and to formulate this condition on the space, initial space-time. Now, it seems to fit in very well with the universe as we know it. It gives you something in which the gravitational degrees of freedom are killed off in the initial state, but it's a trick. Okay, so we have two tricks now. One is one in which the infinity is squashed down to a finite boundary, and the other one is which the Big Bang is stretched out to a finite boundary. Now, there are various different features of this. One is that this thing happens almost automatically. Once one has a cosmological constant, a positive one, which we seem to have, then you find that you have this nice smooth boundary more or less automatically. It just happens. So that's there. We're stuck with it, if you like. Whereas the nature of the initial singularity has a different status. That is to say, that this should be smooth is a requirement which is sort of equivalent to a form of the Weyl curvature hypothesis. So it's a way of saying that the universe has this very, very special character that we seem to find it in. So here it gives us a restriction on universes. Here it's something which happens automatically. Now, I could phrase this a little more strongly. To say that there is this boundary here, in fact, this is very useful mathematically, is you can say that, well, you can actually extend it beyond the boundary, and you have a smooth space, although you have this fictional region to the future of this infinity. And here you can extend this one beyond the boundary, so you have a fictional region earlier than the Big Bang. Now, the crazy thought I want to give you is that maybe this fictional picture is real. So it's not just a mathematical fiction, a mathematical trick, but there really is something beyond infinity. There really is something prior to the Big Bang, and they represent an extension of this conformal geometry, a smooth extension of the conformal geometry. So the picture that I'm trying to present you with is a bit like this here. We could say this is the universe that we know now, and I've squashed down infinity, and I've stretched out the Big Bang. And then that fits on to another universe prior to this, and that fits on to another universe prior to that. So here we have, it's what I'm calling conformal concyclic cosmology, with this being smooth all the way along. Now, in some respects, this is fairly disappointing for quantum gravity theorists, because quantum gravity theorists would like to say, well, something really weird happens at the Big Bang and the Planck scale and all this sort of thing, and you've got to invent all sorts of wild and wonderful kinds of geometry. And the thing is that's being said here is maybe that isn't true, that this Big Bang is actually, as a conformal manifold, completely smooth, and that it's only in the scale factor that you get this blow up, and somewhere quantum theory has to come in to handle that infinity in the scale factor. It doesn't, I should say that, okay, it may be a disappointment to quantum gravity theorists in that respect, but you've still got work to do, not even apart from the scale factor, which of course is a serious matter, but you've got work to do because of the singularities in black holes. And they're all there, certainly. There's no way of getting rid of them in this way. They go away by Hawking evaporation. But they're still there as singularities in which the geometry goes completely wild And so you would certainly need to understand some what on earth can be going on at in the neighborhood of a singularity and gravitational collapse. Well, there are a number of assumptions which are necessary in this picture here. Well, I have a different thing here. This is just a conformal picture according to the diagrams I was giving you a moment ago. There are a lot of, you can call them either requirements or predictions, depending on your state of mind, you see. You could say, this is the more pessimistic version. You say, well, the model needs this, and it needs this, and it needs this. But the other way is to say, well, it predicts this, and it predicts this, and it predicts this. So this is, if you like, the pessimistic and the optimistic view. Well, let's say a positive feature of this scheme is that it gives you Todd's form of the Weyl curvature hypothesis, and therefore the second law of thermodynamics is, in a certain sense, a consequence of this model. But not just that the second law is, but the particular form in which we find it with the Weyl curvature, the gravitational degrees of freedom somehow having been killed off in the initial state. Well, here's some not such good news. In the remote future, you see, you want the black holes to go away. You want massive things to go away. And black holes will go away, according to Hawking, and there'll be a lot of radiation just running around. Well, that's fine. There is a problem, though, that you need somehow electrons to... You have to get rid of electrons. Protons might go via some kind of decay process and so on. Neutrinos are fine if there's a massless one around for everything else to decay into, so that would be okay. We don't know if that's true, of course, but it's not outrageous. What's more outrageous is that the electrons somehow have to lose their mass, or there has to be some lack of conservation of charge or something. I think the least objectionable thing in this scheme is that the electrons, there's some gradual process where the mass disappears. There are some other possibilities where you might imagine that you could deal with this problem. Proton decay or something, well, that's okay. Black holes ultimately decay away. Well, there's some versions of Hawking evaporation in which there's a sort of nugget left over. I don't want that. Let me talk about the observational aspects of this. There are observational consequences, and I think this is what is rather exciting, I think, from this picture. It certainly means that the thing is very... Well, I'm going to suppose that from one phase to the next, the constants of nature do not change. Now, you see, they might. And that would be, okay, you could say either say that's the resort where we go when the theory comes into trouble with observations. You say, oh, well, maybe the constants have been changed, and that's why this has gone wrong. I don't like that, so I'd rather say these constants are not changed from one phase to the next, and then you could make some fairly clear predictions, it seems to me. One of them is the following. You see, in the previous phase, and I'm supposing that it's like ours, so we're going to have galaxies running around with big black holes in their centers, and here I have a sort of cartoon of the black holes spiraling around each other and congealing and producing a lot of gravitational radiation. Now, this gravitational radiation actually leaves its mark on infinity. It doesn't completely... Okay, the Weyl curvature goes to zero, but the normal derivative across the surface of the Weyl curvature does not go to zero. And so there will be a mark left by this gravitational radiation, which, if this is to be a continuous geometry or a smooth geometry from one to the next, will still leave its mark on the Big Bang of the next model. And that will give rise to, by the Bianchi identities, will give rise to deviations from uniformity in the Ricci tensor, probably pretty small, because one's looking for effects of the gravitational radiation in the previous phase, but not ignorable. And these will give you density irregularities of a mild kind. And one would have to see whether they square with what one actually sees in, say, WMAP and these other satellites which are looking at the variations in the temperature in the microwave background. So it makes predictions about that. Does it give you predictions like those of inflation in the sense of having a sort of scale invariance? I think it's very likely that it would. Roughly speaking, it's that you don't have inflation here, but you have inflation before the Big Bang. It's a bit like in, I think, Veneziano had some scheme a bit like that already. So it's possible that you have things like that. You also will get correlations, you see. If there's a collision of black holes here, they will produce radiation, and so there will be correlations at different parts of the Big Bang. And so this is one of the puzzling features if you have no inflation in your cosmological models, because it seems there are correlations between regions which are in the standard cosmology outside the horizons of each other. But here, you see, that's what you would expect, because the correlations come from the previous phase. So that's something to be looked at in detail to see whether this scheme survives the observations. But it seems to me there's a lot that one might imagine being set up against the observation. Gravitation, primordial gravitational radiation, I think you would expect some of that. And so maybe that would be picked up also by observational devices. Okay, so I haven't in detail looked at all these things. I've tried to think about them, but it needs some very detailed work to see what the predictions of this model really are. One of the big issues that needs to be faced is getting back to this whole question of the phase-based volume and how that makes sense through this succession of universes. And one of the features which one has to worry about is that the phase space has a natural volume measure. See, at first I thought the infinite rescaling of the metric is going to sort out the phase space issues, but you have a quantum theory determines a volume. So unless you're going to monkey with the laws of quantum mechanics through these processes, and maybe one should, it's not quite clear, there is an issue to be faced. So I've listed a problem that one has to face up to about how the entire phase space of the previous phase is in a certain sense squashed into the phase space of the Big Bang of the next lot. Well, the gravitational degrees of freedom, do they scale away? I'm not sure that I believe these ones. Are you saved by the volumes actually being infinite? I don't think that's the answer. Does somehow H bar get renormalized? I don't tend to believe that is the answer, but one has to think about these things. The most likely thing, it seems to me, is that there's a balance in the information loss. See, Hawking evaporation is a certain sense in which you lose information, and a lot of people don't like that and try to argue against that happening. It seems to me it's hard to get around it, and so that amounts, in fact, to phase space volume being lost through each phase here. And I think it's quite possible that that is the thing one has to look at to make the balance in this picture work out. But again, it's something which I haven't followed through in detail, and it needs a lot more work. So I think I'll stop at this point. Thank you very much.
Einstein's gravitational field equations are not conformally invariant because the trace of the energy momentum tensor is not zero. Mm-hmm. So how do you, I guess you've already, you pointed out that you have to get rid of you have to get rid of mass, or else you have to stop the breaking of the conformal invariance, maybe spontaneously. Mm. Also, throughout this, you've assumed that that we do have singularities, maybe some wild quantum gravity theory or string people are always saying this, that you can get rid of singularities. So that would change the whole picture, possibly.
Yeah, well, first of all, the second question, as I tried to say, you certainly, the singularities and collapse in the black holes will need some wild kind of quantum geometry. the viral curvature will diverge to infinity, and yes, there's no way of getting around that as far as I can see. But as far as the Big Bang is concerned, you might be able to get away with it, because the geometry, in this picture, the geometry doesn't go wild or anything. It's just a perfectly good, smooth, conformal geometry. So that you expect to see a very large time asymmetry in that description. This model certainly leads you to treating the two kinds of singularities very differently. But you don't get away from quantum gravity in the sense of wild local geometry, because you need that in the singularities of collapse. However, the singularity at the Big Bang is something which does seem to be very, very organized and smooth, and part of that is observational, the fact that the universe seems to have been very, very uniform. And so one doesn't seem to see wild behavior in the geometry there. But okay, it's all up for grabs. We don't really know what happens. As far as your other point is concerned, I am supposing that, perhaps I didn't make it clear enough, but I am supposing that in the remote future, there's nothing left but massless radiation, and that has vanishing trace. And so conformal invariance is okay for that situation. You do, in fact. There's other little points which I should have perhaps said a little more. As far as gravity is concerned, gravity is not conformally invariant, but in the sort of limit that you're looking at here, the effective gravitational constant goes away. And so gravity is just like a spin 2 field on a background in the remote future. A point that I forgot to emphasize is the other way around. When you're looking at the Big Bang, again, you have conformal invariance likely to be the dominant thing. You see, you have very, very high temperatures near the Big Bang, and so it's reasonable that as long as there aren't infinite towers of mass going right up, that mass becomes irrelevant near the Big Bang. It's also, as I understand from particle physics friends of mine, it's reasonable to suppose that the interactions, if mass goes to zero, which is effectively zero in the Big Bang, that the interactions are effectively conformally invariant in the Big Bang. Of course, that's a question, but it seems to be consistent with what we know at the moment. So the view would be, okay, conformal physics holds at both ends, both in the remote future and near the Big Bang, for different reasons, though. In the remote future, you've got to get rid of massive things, and that's why I worry about the electrons. But okay, if they go away somehow, that's fine. In the Big Bang, it sort of happens automatically that the conformal invariance is a reasonable proposal for the relevant physics near the Big Bang. But then you need to get rid of the gravity in order for it to make sense at all. And that's the viral curvature hypothesis. So that's what you need to make this scheme work. But there are lots of things that need to be sorted out there.
Sorry, so just a very basic misunderstanding. So if you were to shrink the scale factor so that the current observable universe, let's say, were to become smaller than the Planck scale and then continue shrinking it past that point, are you, you know, hypothesizing that physics continues to make sense there? Hypothesizing that it continues to be physically sensible to talk about things that are, you know, exponentially smaller than the Planck scale?
Well, you have to worry. I mean, we don't really know what to do with the Planck scale. You see, it's the argument is that whatever quantum gravity is, somehow the Planck scale's got to come into it. But we know, mm-hmm. you know, there are lots of theories people have. Mm-hmm. And the proposal here is it's not such a dangerous thing at all. The Planck scale is not playing any particular role, that the geometry can be regarded as a sensible, as a conformal geometry, right down to the Big Bang, and you go right through it. Mm-hmm. So that's the proposal here. Okay. And since we don't know what quantum gravity is anyway, I mean, you know, you can make one proposal or another. So at least this proposal comes to terms with the very, very special nature of the Big Bang. It doesn't, in the case of the singularities in black holes, okay, we still need to worry about that. But it does need something going beyond general relativity as we know it now, in which you embed the present theory into something which is a conformal theory. And there are various ideas for doing that. It's certainly, there's quite a lot of scope for that. There are things called conformal gravity and so on, which you have to think of ways of killing off the extra freedom, which is there in completely conformally invariant theories. So there has to be more than that in this. But again, it's not something that I've been able to work through in detail. I have some ideas about it, but I haven't something which I can just tell you is what I think the theory is. It does need some version of Einstein's general relativity in which you have conformal invariance. And you can certainly do that by introducing a conformal factor as another field. And then you say when that conformal factor is one, you've got general relativity, but it's you've got more freedom because it can go to zero and still make sense. I need it to go not just to zero, but also to infinity and still make sense. But that's at least plausible.
I think even more peculiar than the Big Bang being homogeneous is the fact that it's not exactly homogeneous. There's a 10 to the minus 5 there.
Okay.
And it looks like that in your model you'd actually get zero level of fluctuations.
No, that's what I'm trying to say here. It's actually not. It's necessarily not homogeneous because the gravitational radiation in processes like these black holes coming together will actually leave its mark on Sky Plus, on future null infinity.
But I would expect an infinite period to go between that final stage of the black holes and the time in which you actually glue the infinity and the Big Bang. So things should homogenize completely in that infinite time.
No. No. You're saying it should homogenize?
Yeah.
No, it won't. No, that certainly is not the case in this model. In this model, okay, it will be pretty homogeneous because of all, you know, it expands and the radiation just runs around randomly. That's fine. But there will be black holes colliding into each other and producing radiation. That radiation definitely produces its mark on Sky Plus. You just follow the equations of the radiation as it goes out, and okay, the Weyl curvature goes to zero. There's a relative scaling between the in the conformal picture, you will have the conformal curvature going to zero, but the normal derivative of the conformal curvature is necessarily not zero. And that's a measure of the intensity of the gravitational radiation, which would be a perfectly finite thing on that boundary. So there will be a normal derivative in the Weyl curvature, which will give rise to irregularities in the density on the next phase. That's just a feature of the Bianchi identities. You'll find that the Ricci curvature has to have certain variations spatially.
So where do you pull
that? So there's a real prediction here that it will tell you, if you believe that the universe here is more or less like ours, then you can make some kind of estimate as to how much gravitational radiation will be present through these black hole collisions, and that will tell us something about irregularities in the density.
So basically you get to 10 to the minus 5 from some parameter like the amount of radiation.
Yeah, it doesn't seem unreasonable you get a number of that sort, but let me not say any more than that because it really does need a detailed analysis, and that I haven't done.
Well, there's a number of things that come out of this, but I'll ask one question just for fun. This is an infinite strip, but is there any reason other than aesthetics to not identify the infinite squash in our future with the infinite stretch in our past?
Yes, I think there is reason. Mainly consistency, because just in relation to my comment to the previous question, see, there will be effects coming through from the previous phase. And if this has got to match, it's got to match up here as well, you see. If you want this to match with this, that's a huge constraint on the physics. And it's got to, what happens to black holes as they spiral into each other in the remote future has to be related to what happens in this past. And that's a kind of consistency condition which, although not manifestly impossible, is nevertheless very uncomfortable for the kind of physics that we know, where somehow you've got freedom
I guess I would have thought it might have been more attractive because it would be such a tight consistency condition, it might be possible to actually rule out that possibility.
I see what you mean. Well, that could be. I'm not too fond of it because it's sort of like the reasons that one had against time, you know, closed time-like curves and models where you have to match the future with the past, which introduce all sorts of nastiness with regard to the equations. You certainly have constraints on the solutions. You might say that's a good thing, but I don't like it much. But okay, you said any reason other than aesthetics. Well, you might likely to identify these things. My personal view is that that would be not a probable situation, that these would be just different phases, one after the other. You see, if you're of the opinion that you want constants of nature to change, then, of course, you'd like that. But I'm not of that opinion, but it does give you the scope to have constants of nature change. I think, from my point of view, that will be a weaselly thing, because it means that you can make all these nice, clear predictions. You see the predictions are refuted by observation. They say, oh, well, that probably is an indication that constants of nature have been changing each time. Well, that's sort of the floodgates are open at that stage, and more or less anything can happen.
Any other questions? If not, then please join me in thanking Roger.